You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Sarah Rule's play, The Clean House, which was staged recently at Lincoln Center, was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. Last fall, she won a MacArthur Genius Grant. And now another of her plays, Eurydice, a retelling of the Orpheus myth from the point of view of his wife, is being performed at the Second Stage Theater. Charles Isherwood of the New York Times has called it a rhapsodically beautiful production. And I'm very pleased that all of that has brought Sarah Rule to my show today. Hello.
Thank you so much for having me.
Over the years, the Orpheus myth has been the subject of plays, and we had Tennessee Williams' Orpheus Descending, films, operas, ballets, novels, and poetry. What do you think its appeal is?
I think there's something about the tragedy being contained in that one moment of looking back, that there's something so iconic about this one gesture. I look back and I lose my entire life.
It's like Lot's wife, only in a way it's a little more poetic.
Yeah, it's like Lot's wife, or it's like that beautiful Auden poem about Icarus, that disastrous things happen in the blink of an eye.
But in this case, you've decided to tell the story from Eurydice's point of view. And your mentor, I don't know what other word to use, Paula Vogel, once rewrote Othello from the point of view of Desdemona.
I love that play.
Yep. Was that an inspiration?
Gosh, unconsciously, it probably was.
What do we get out of reimagining classics from a woman's point of view? Although, I guess in some classics we have women, so we'd have to imagine them from the the man's point of view.
No,
Medea.
That
well, just think of Medea from Jason's point of view.
I think David Mamet should write that. I mean,
I think he's written it a couple of times.
What do we get from imagining it from a woman's point of view? I mean, I think Eurydice has been such a cipher in all of these retellings. We don't know what happens to her. She's completely off stage. So I think you get a fuller imagining of the event somehow.
And in this case, you've made her a modern woman because it seems to be set more or less in the present with a high-rise apartment building, elevators figuring in the story. Does setting it in the modern era change how an audience will relate to the characters?
Well, I want people to feel connected to it. I mean, I think it's very hard doing the Greeks and just doing the Greeks proper and people having an emotional pipeline in, because there's something distancing about the language of the Greeks and the formalism of the Greeks. So I didn't want people to come in and feel like it was going to be pillars and formalism and togas. I wanted it to feel like, oh, these are people I know. That could be my father, that could be my grandmother, that could, you know.
Well, in your notes, you write, Eurydice and Orpheus should be played as though they are a little too young and a little too in love. They should resist the temptation to be classical.
Yeah.
So you see them as a contemporary couple.
Absolutely, yeah.
They appear to be grappling with what their relationship should be. Do you think that relationship might have been tested if they hadn't been parted right after the wedding?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it is kind of always sad to imagine the great lovers in the trivial everyday world of coffee cups and picking up after each other.
Well, in this play, Eurydice is reunited with her father in the underworld. Is it true? Forgive me, I suddenly got that tickle, you know?
I'm sorry about your cough.
It's one of those things that just suddenly comes over you.
Yeah.
Is it true that you wrote this shortly after your own father's death? And was that something you were thinking about at the time?
I was. My father died when I was 20. He died of cancer. And I think that when I wrote the play, I didn't consciously think, oh, I'll write a play about the afterlife so that I can visit my father. But I think that when I started writing the play and followed Eurydice to the underworld, I thought, oh, she meets her ancestors there. And so naturally, she met her father. So I think in some ways, writing this play was a healing thing for me to do.
Well, when Orpheus and Eurydice marry, we see her father taking part in the ceremony, even though he's dead. And I guess that's something that we all have experienced, feeling that a lost loved one is somehow there, a presence in the room.
Yeah, it is a strange, unearthly thing, and I know a lot of people who've experienced it, and I think that's, you know, when you lose a parent and you go through this rite of passage like a wedding, you always imagine that they're there walking you down. Or
well, the Greeks really did talk about the big psychological stuff. You would have thought that we really didn't even need Freud. and the play focuses on Eurydice's experiences in the underworld. And when Orpheus comes down to rescue her, she has to choose between him and her father.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that many women have to face, at least on an unconscious level, when they decide to get married.
Well, and I do think the Greeks had it right. And I think there's something prescient about you saying, we didn't even need Freud, because that's how I often feel
well,
when
he often
go to
named
the
stuff. He said the Oedipal complex.
Yeah, I think he was reaching back to something that the Greeks already knew about. And I think we don't hear about the triangle with the father, the daughter, and the husband as much as we hear about Oedipus's dilemma. And I think, you know, for women who are 18 coming to see the show, I think, you know, women who are 17, 18 coming to see the play seem to connect so viscerally to it. And I think it's something about, at that age, it's not even abstract, you know, the choice between father and boyfriend. It's a very real thing.
Your notes say that the underworld should resemble the world of Alice in Wonderland more than it resembles Hades.
Yeah.
And your plays have often been described as whimsical, surreal, magic realist. Are those categories useful in defining what you're trying to do in the other work and in this play?
Well, I love the magical realist, and I'm very happy to be thrown in with Marquez, but I don't know. I was reading Milan Kundera's book, The Curtain, recently, and he was talking about how Kafka was described as magical or absurd, and saying, no, actually, Kafka was a realist. He was just describing the world in the most accurate way he possibly could. But the world he was living in was so absurd that people needed to categorize it in some way. So when I sit down to write, I don't think to myself, oh, how could I make this heightened or other. I just, in some way, am trying to transcribe emotional perceptions.
My guest is Sarah Rule, whose latest play is Eurydice, and it is being performed at the Second Stage on West 43rd Street, just west of 8th Avenue. Did you play a part in the design of the set? Scott Bradley said it's a kind of a tiled Roman bath all done in shades of turquoise and aquamarine, and it's kind of on a tilt.
You know, I usually do, but in this case, Scott actually dreamed the set after reading it. It was this extraordinary thing where he seemed to dream it complete, this idea of an upside-down world where the floor becomes the ceiling, and I don't want to spoil it for everyone, but chandeliers come out of the ground. And you know, everyone who was involved in the play had recently lost someone, and Scott had recently lost his partner, and Les had recently lost his father. So there was a strange little crucible of people missing other people who were working on the show. So I think Scott's set is, in a way, a love poem to his partner.
The play has been produced around the country in Madison, Wisconsin, Berkeley, Yale. Have you done any rewriting along the way?
I can't help myself. And I mean, it's good I had another play opening at the same time so that I would race to Washington and not make too many changes, because you know what they say about the third grader's painting, that's genius if you take it away from them at the right moment, and otherwise it just turns to mud. You know, I felt that happening. Or when you tweeze.
Stop me before
stop,
I
stop.
Add another character, yeah. Another line.
You tweeze your eyebrows too much and suddenly they're 2 inches between them. I mean, I was making little cuts, you know, up until the last gasp.
Have any of the cast members been with you from the beginning?
Yes, Maria Dizia has been there since the beginning, who plays Eurydice. And
she's extraordinary.
Isn't she wonderful?
An amazing actress, and I wonder whether it's because she's so familiar with these lines that she just does it so amazingly, or is it just that you lucked out when you found her?
Well, I think she has a simplicity and a translucence that's very hard to find. I mean, actors go to acting school and they learn to be actors, and with that becomes the kind of accoutrements of acting, and Maria manages to strip that away. And I remember her saying when we first did the play, she said, I'm scared, to the director. She said, there are no pillars to hide behind in this play. You know, so this idea that it needed to be very vulnerable and stripped away, and she does it every night, and it must be exhausting.
the other members of the cast as well, Joseph Parks, Charles Shaw Robinson, who does a wonderful dance, Mark Zeisler. Now, this play, as I said, has been performed elsewhere first, and The Clean House was staged in a number of cities around the country before it was finally brought to Lincoln Center. Is it that hard to get a, or did you not want to have these plays come to New York first?
I certainly would have been willing. I mean, I had had readings of the plays in New York, I think, before they were done regionally. But I think New York is a scary place right now in terms of theater, and people are scared to take risks on new work. So I think in my case...
But The Clean House, nominated for Pulitzer and got incredibly good reviews, had a nice run. You would think that that track record would mean something. I know. Yeah. Joseph, I know Edward Albee at a certain point swore off of New York, and mm-hmm. David Rabe swore off of New York mm-hmm. because of these problems. Mm-hmm. Is this really that hard a city for a playwright? Even one who's made a reputation?
Well, I love New York, and I love New Yorkers, so I think the problem is economic and systematic. I don't think it's the people who come to see the theater here.
When you do an earlier version elsewhere, does that production create a template for all the future versions?
Yes and no. I mean, like, for example, Scott's Beautiful Set, I don't then write in the Samuel French version, and you must have letters up into infinity, into the sky. I leave it really open so that everyone can bring their own vision to it.
Last year you received a MacArthur so-called Genius Award, and that means you don't have to really worry about money for a while. Has it freed you up to write what you want to write?
Yeah, it's incredibly liberating. And for me, I just had a baby a year ago, so having money for babysitters when I need it to get the writing done is pretty incredible.
I noticed the reviews for both Eurydice and The Clean House were somewhat polarized. People seem to either adore what you do or they just don't seem to get it. Do you think that maybe you've generated a backlash after all the accolades, the Pulitzer nomination, the MacArthur?
Well, I do wish, you called it the so-called Genius Award. I do wish it were just completely just called the MacArthur Fellowship so that you wouldn't have that kind of circle on your back.
Oh, if I win it, I want it to be called the Genius Award.
Oh, yeah, the polarization is interesting. I'm not totally aware of it because my mother and husband try to shield me from the really nasty ones, but you know they're out there, and I guess you hope that what you write will find its people, you know.
Well, you also are pushing things a bit. You started off The Clean House with a very long joke told in Portuguese and didn't translate it.
Yeah.
I had to go elsewhere to find out what the joke was. It was very funny. People would have laughed.
Well, this is one thing I do think is, I do sometimes think experimental theater, weirdly enough, is being done outside of New York more and more often because of the fears and the risks here.
And that's happening again with your new one, right? Dead Man's Cell Phone, recently opened in Washington, D.C.
I did open it in Washington, and that's it's a strange little play, and I wanted an audience that would come to it hoping for strange surprises, and the Woolly Mammoth audience is kind of bred on that kind of play.
I've also heard that you're writing a play about the history of the vibrator. Is that true?
I am. Yeah, I was fascinated to learn. This is an extraordinary book called The Technology of Orgasm, and I learned in it about the fact that psychiatrists and doctors used to use vibrators on their patients, and they were so relieved when the vibrator came out because they were like, what used to take us hours now took just a matter of minutes. So before the vibrator, they had digitally, stimulated women to paroxysm. I don't know what the proper radio words are, but paroxysm is the word that they use.
I think the FCC doesn't know what it means, so it's okay. And that, I don't know how visual you're going to get in that play, but if it ever opens in New York, we'll find out.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Eurydice has been extended twice, and the latest extension is until August 12th. Is there a chance? Because when I went, there were people waiting to hoping that somebody didn't show up so that they could get in. There was a long waiting line.
Yeah, tickets have been selling, so it might extend further. Who knows?
It's at the Second Stage Theater at 307 West 43rd Street. And I want to thank you so much for being with us, Sarah Rule.
Thank you so much for having me.